Benjamin and Scott versus Stater. You ready to proceed?
Yes.
Very well.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Nicole Walker and I represent the appellant, Mr. Jeffrey Scott. There are two issues before the court today. The first one is whether Mr. Scott's right to be free from an unlawful search was violated when the police searched his home at night. And the second issue is whether his right to cross-examination was violated when he was prohibited from questioning April Stinson regarding her entry into the drug diversion program. The answer to both of these questions is yes, his rights were violated. Did the court need to hear the statement of the facts?
No, but I would like you to clear up one factual matter, at least for me, and that is the status of the house. I know there was crime scene tape.
Yes.
But there are apparently at least two tenants, and it was represented that one of them wanted to get back in.
Yes.
So my question is, were police actually stationed at the property that would have precluded reentry by anyone, or if the co-tenant, for want of a better term, had come back with a key and gone inside, could they have done that?
My understanding from the review of the record is that, in fact, it was secured by the tape as well as police officers. The doors were locked and the windows were also locked.
Where in the record would I know the tape was there, the doors were locked, the windows were locked. Where would I find in the record an indication that there was a police presence there that would have precluded reentry?
Your Honor, I don't have that directly before me. I'd be more than happy to go through the record and find that for the court. It may not specifically say. That is my understanding based on what the procedure usually is. The concern here is not necessarily that a co-tenant, which there was some dispute in the record as to whether or not she was a co-tenant. The defendant stated on the record that she was not. That was later supported by trial testimony. However, assuming she was a co-tenant, it wasn't her per se that wanted to go in. It was her family. And that seems to be, that was one of the two sets of facts that the police officers asserted as exigent circumstances. And the language in paragraph 12, which is where they talk about specifically Ms. Odwin's family wanting to go in the house, I think makes it very clear that the search warrant was issued more for convenience to the family than because of a concern that the evidence would be removed. In fact, in Mason versus State, this court stated that they have to show, the state has a burden to show, that there was a likelihood of immediate threat that the evidence would be lost.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought I understood the record to be that young children were involved and that the family had control of the young children and the family needed to get back to get items for the young children.
Right.
And what the police were trying to do was accommodate the family after the crime had been committed.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. That's what I think the record demonstrates, and that clearly is not a basis for a nighttime search warrant. They would have to, first of all, there's nothing in the record to support how the family indicated they wanted to go back in. I mean, there's a difference between them saying off the cuff, you know, we'd really like to go get their stuff, versus trying to break into the house, and that was not in the record. The state has the burden to show that there was an immediate threat of the loss of evidence, and that just wasn't present in this case.
Well, what about trace evidence? The trial judge spoke of trace evidence of being lost.
Well, Your Honor, excuse me, that is a concern. However, what the record shows is they arrived on the scene at 11 o'clock. The search was eventually conducted at 2, and if they had conducted a legal search, we're talking 6 a.m., there's nothing to indicate in the record, nothing was presented, that the trace evidence would, in fact, be lost if everything was actually locked up. There's no indication of that. So that would be speculation, and the court said you have to, because of that, that you have to construe removal broadly. And that's just not supported by case law. Case law says that the purpose of the exigent circumstance requirement is to protect the sanctity of the home. And that is why Delaware has such a high standard. They can't, the state cannot just speculate, well, we might have lost some trace evidence.
Also, trace evidence refers to what? I mean, we're talking about microscopic items,
I would imagine blood, that type of thing, maybe fingerprints.
Fibers.
And I don't believe that they indicated how those would be lost with a locked house, no one entering it. There's just nothing in the record to support that.
But if anyone even sets foot in the house, you could have trace evidence on the floor, for instance, that a footprint would go over and remove.
That's correct. I agree with that. However, the house was secured. There was no threat that anybody would get into the house.
And what's the authority to secure the house?
Well, that's another issue. I don't think that they had a basis to secure the house.
Well, then how can you rely on securing the house then as a justification to wait?
Well, there's two alternative arguments here. First of all, the state did not have the right to secure the house as there was an unnatural death, yes, but the crime had already been committed. There was nothing to indicate that there was anyone else in the home that was a perpetrator.
Well, and the record seems to proceed on a different assumption, because either it must have been the affidavit that recites the house can't be released. That's the word used.
Yes.
Until we execute the warrant. So the police at least were under the assumption that they could secure the premises until the warrant had been executed, and they weren't going to release it, that's their word, to the family to get the children's items. Is that right?
Right. That's exactly right, Your Honor. But that doesn't make the basis correct, the fact that they had the house secured.
Could I focus on a slightly different side of this problem? What evidence was recovered as a result of this search?
I believe, Your Honor,
generally.
Sorry, I believe that I have it here. They obtained a bent carving knife with the knife blade, okay, and then without the handle, and then they recovered a knife handle separately. They also obtained butcher knife and blood sample. And again, there's indication of trace evidence, but I'm not sure exactly what type of evidence that is. These were all used in in obtaining a conviction against Mr. Scott.
Let's assume for the moment that evidence was not part of the trial. Wouldn't there still be a conviction based upon all of the testimony, including your client's statements and his condition and everything else that all the rest of the evidence? This seemed like a fairly strong case.
Well, in this case, I know that the state in its brief indicates that there was an eyewitness, Dominique Curd, who was the victim's daughter. The record actually shows that she testified that she didn't see Mr. Scott with a knife. So that there was dispute with respect to that. So whether the jury would believe that or not, alone without physical evidence, is in question. She also was the victim's daughter, with a motive, obviously, to obtain a conviction. In addition, this was physical evidence. The testimony that was presented, and I'll address the defendant's statement, but the testimony that was presented by Ms. Curd, as well as the neighbor, with respect to seeing Mr. Scott throw Ms. Curd out the window, okay, that does not contribute to his conviction. Mr. Scott's statements, as we know, in and of itself, is not sufficient to convict him. There would need to be some physical evidence present. He was drunk that night. The jury may have had a question as to whether or not everything he said was correct. And I think, in fact, you know,
what he said was that he would do the time, he did it, and he seemed to not leave much doubt.
He did say that I did it and I will do the time. He also said, and also questioned, what did I do at one point in the facts. It indicates that he asked that, indicating maybe he didn't know exactly what he was confessing to.
And wasn't there also physical evidence in terms of him having cuts on him?
Yes, but his argument was later self-defense, and that could indicate anything. When he said, I did it, he's not a lawyer, obviously. He doesn't know to what degree he may have defenses, et cetera. He did have cuts on his hand. That, again, in and of itself is not sufficient to convict him of murder.
Well, what I'm trying to get at is this. If if you don't have the actual murder weapon, but you have all of the results of the use of that murder weapon in terms of cuts on the victim and cuts on the defendant, then obviously somebody was wielding a knife,
correct,
or more than one knife. And he's also admitted that he did it, and all of the other testimony from witnesses, even if it's not perfect, supports the chain of events as described in the testimony. So how much more does the actual weapon add to the case, one way or another?
Well, with respect to the weapon, whether there's fingerprints on the weapon is significant because, as the court indicated, somebody was wielding the weapon. We don't know who, except that Mr. Scott indicated that he did it.
So in other words, at the trial there was fingerprint evidence presented?
That's a good question, Your Honor. I will check with that before rebuttal. I think I have the answer to that. I think that one thing that's significant is he did later do a self-defense argument. You know, whether or not, and again, I'll double-check the status of the record, whether or not Ms. Kern had used the weapon, here's what he claimed that she actually had, would go possibly to support his self-defense claim in this case. The other thing that's important is because this is the exigent circumstances is designed to protect the sanctity of the home, it's important to realize that admitting plainly relevant evidence which possibly influenced the jury adversely to a litigant cannot be conceived as harmless. And I think that's the key to this case as well, is the whole purpose behind the exigent circumstance requirement.
Excuse me, are you saying that you can't have harmless error if the issue is whether there was an improper search?
You can't have harmless error with respect to exigent circumstances. And my assertion to that is that it's different than probable cause, and that exigent circumstances are this court has not ruled that the determination of exigent circumstances is similar to probable cause. The police would then be able to make a subjective determination that exigent circumstances exist, and then go back later and say, well, it didn't affect his particular case, therefore it was okay.
I'm having trouble understanding you. Is there some authority for the proposition that you cannot use a harmless error analysis with respect to the trial itself, and if the question is whether there was a search warrant that was improperly executed and there were no exigent circumstances?
No, there's no blanket authority saying you can't use harmless error analysis to answer the question. But the United States Supreme Court has noted that the state has to prove, they have the burden to prove, that in no way did this evidence contribute to his conviction. And I think what's important to that is the testimony, that there really was no eyewitness testimony that was plain. There may have been question in the jury's mind. We obviously can't read the jury's mind, but there may have been questions with respect to the validity of his quote-unquote confession as to what he meant when he said, I did it. And if he did it in self-defense, that's different, obviously, than doing it to commit murder.
Well, the evidence that was found as a result of the search warrant really doesn't cast light on that one way or the other, does it?
Well, it may, depending on where the weapon was laying, okay, as to whether or not he claimed that Ms. Currid actually had the knife in her hand. Again, I will double check on the fingerprinting issue, but that would be significant, obviously, one way or another. He may not have had to go that far to make a self-defense argument if that wasn't present. What physical evidence does is significantly corroborate the testimony of people who are not necessarily independent witnesses. There was one independent witness who was the neighbor, and there's an issue with respect to her not being properly cross-examined with respect to bias, but there was obviously bias by the victim's daughter because she was, in fact, had a motive to obtain a conviction.
Did you want to save the rest of your time, or did you want to address the second issue?
Is the court interested in the second issue?
Well, you know, it's your appeal.
Yes, sure.
You can address it. You can rely on your brief. We'll certainly consider it.
Okay. With respect to the cross-examination issue, the trial court made a very narrow finding that it did not, the drug diversion did not amount to a conviction under 609.
I want to see if there's agreement on this point in terms of what drug diversion is. This was a Track 2 drug diversion?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And,
sorry.
It's not what the witness had a right to elect to go to Track 2. It's discretionary with the Attorney General?
Yes, Your Honor.
So the Attorney General decides whether that person is eligible for the program, which ultimately could result in a nolle pros and even an expungement of the arrest.
That's correct, Your Honor. And with respect to that, the court was correct that that wouldn't be a conviction under 609.
Well, am I correct that there was an alternative argument whether or not it comes under 609? It's the type of impeachment bias evidence that should be permitted in a proper cross-examination.
That's correct, and that's what we rely upon, Your Honor. And actually, this is very similar to the case of Alford versus United States, and as the court will recall, in that case, the attorney sought to question the witness with respect to where he lived, and he knew he was incarcerated at the time. And the trial court said, you can't ask that question because you're trying to find out whether he had convictions. The United States Supreme Court said, no, he can't ask that question because it goes to whether or not the witness had motivation to obtain curry favor from the government. And in that case, there was no express agreement between the government and the witness. And that's one of the things that the court also erroneously relied upon, saying, well, there's nothing in the record to show there was an express agreement. That's for the jury to determine. This entry into the drug diversion was just days before she testified, and it was for felony charges. And I think that under 616, this evidence should have been permitted. She was the independent witness who corroborated the daughter of the victim. Therefore, it could not have been a harmless error. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Williams.
Good morning, Justice Holland, Justice Berger, Justice Ridgeley. May it please the court. I'll address the two issues in the sequence they were presented in the brief. Turning first to the pretrial evidence suppression motion, the state's position is that there was no abuse of discretion by the Superior Court judge in denying the defense pretrial evidence suppression motion. What was at issue here was apparently nine items of physical evidence. There were three blood swabbings, a couple of knives or part of knives. There was a purse, some keys, and I believe two telephones that were actually seized when the nighttime search warrant was executed.
Can you address the issue of whether the scene was secured and monitored by police so no one could go in, or was it just basically taped and locked?
I don't know if an officer was physically present all of the time. There were officers there at the beginning. There was certainly testimony about that. There were two doors, a front door and a back door, and when the search warrant was being applied for, I think the representation was that crime scene tape was placed and that certainly the doors and windows were locked. I don't know if an officer was physically present at the two doors or not.
What is the authority of the police to stop someone from going in?
Well, I think at that point it was obvious that it was a homicide scene, a crime scene, and the police certainly have inherent authority to secure that and to gather evidence, and that was the basis for making sure no one entered the house, that I think the first officer actually may have come in through the back door. His testimony was he entered partially into a kitchen. The complicating factor in all this was that there was a power outage at this time, and that portion of Dover, and that the apartment or the housing unit itself was actually dark. And then he backed out and told another officer not to come in. So I think what the police were doing was certainly trying to secure what was obviously a crime scene. The victim was outside the residence on the ground, and I don't know if the paramedics arrived before or after the police, but it was obvious that she was either severely injured or was dead on the scene. So that was the authority of the police to go ahead and secure the crime scene.
Well, there are two ways to look at the exigent circumstances. One is if the police had the authority to secure the scene and it was secured, there was a need to get the warrant executed so they could turn the property over to the family so they could get the children's items. A different exigent circumstance might be the need to execute the warrant before the family just went back in because the house was not secure. So are they the two choices, and is the state's argument in the alternative, or are there other exigent circumstances?
Well, I think the other potential exigent circumstance that never was totally explored was the concern of the police that even if everything was locked up, that Kim Odom's relatives might have a key or the ability to access the unit. They were the individuals who were seeking to obtain the children's clothing.
Well, that's the second in my example, which is based on the assumption that the police had not totally secured the premises and could prevent all entry. Because if they could prevent all entry, nothing was going to be disturbed because no one was going to go in. And the only exigent circumstance then would be expediting the warrant so they could give the clothes or other items of the children to the family.
Well, I think that, and plus they were dealing with blood evidence here, too. There were three blood swabbings. And usually what you want to do is go ahead and do that as promptly as possible. That's the type of physical evidence that is susceptible to possible disintegration or contamination.
Where is that in the record? I remember reference to trace evidence. I don't remember the discussion about the need to collect blood evidence.
Oh, I don't know if there was an actual discussion about that. There were three blood swabbings, I know, that were actually obtained during the search, and that's the basis for that. I'm not sure exactly what the warrant said in terms of
if it wasn't within the affidavit, it's not a consideration here.
No, you have to look to the four corners of the affidavit, and I just don't recall, but that was obviously the concern. She Elaine Kurt, had been stabbed 11 times. Mr. Scott himself apparently had 5 lacerations on his hand, so there was a concern about blood evidence being present and at least an attempt to try to secure that evidence as promptly as possible. In this case,
let me interrupt. Under the state's analysis here, wouldn't we basically be saying that any time there's a crime scene and the crime happens at nighttime, the police can do a nighttime search and not have to wait until the next day, because there's always going to be evidence of the crime at the crime scene, and if putting the tape around the building and securing it from the outside isn't good enough, then it'll just be standard operating procedure to say, well, it's nighttime, we don't want to have to wait until the morning because anything could happen between now and then, and so we need a nighttime search warrant.
Well, that's kind of the flip side of what the trial judge said. The trial judge said, well, the argument that defense is making would mean that you're never going to be able to do a nighttime search, because why can't you always just wait till 6 a.m.?
Well, and that's really what I'm asking is that I could see where if there were something that is actually going to disintegrate, or if the crime scene was a place that couldn't be secured because of the nature of what it was, that would present a different set of circumstances. But why why allow a nighttime search if you can secure the premises and if everything should be the same 4 or 5 hours later as it is in the nighttime?
Well, I think the concern, at least as expressed in the warrant, and that's what we have to look at, the four corners of the affidavit supporting the warrant application, was that they were concerned about Kim Odom's relatives trying to get back into the apartment to obtain the children's clothing and other items.
And we're to make a ruling that the police couldn't restrain the relatives from coming back into the house?
Well, I think that's a question of, is that sufficient exigent circumstances or not? And the magistrate certainly found that it was, and the trial judge agreed with that finding. I think on the record that's before the court, there is a sufficient basis for exigent circumstances to be found here. Otherwise, what the police would be left with doing is they obtained the warrant, I believe, shortly after 2 a.m. They would have to wait another 4 hours before they could lawfully enter the house without a warrant and conduct the search. So it's
what
a question.
What are the limits of what the police can do in response to a 911 call to a homicide? I mean, they come to the house, say the homicide's in progress, and they enter the house and try and stop it. Can they seize a weapon then, or do they have to go get a search warrant because it's nighttime?
Well, I think under that hypothetical, they could seize the weapon because if they see the weapon, it's in plain view, and they're simply responding to an emergency call. There's a crime in progress, so that's their authority to enter the residence at that time.
Were the police, on the facts of this case, in the house at one point before getting the warrant anyway?
One of the officers testified that he had entered into the back door where the kitchen was. I think the homicide actually occurred in a front living room. And then he said he went partially into the kitchen. There was another officer behind him, and he told the other officer to stay out. And then he said he went retraced his steps and went back out the back door. So I think the victim herself was out in the front of the residence. The body was there.
What can he do if he's lawfully there under exigent circumstances in response to a 911 call that there's a stabbing taking place? What can he do in terms of evidence gathering, evidence of a crime? He obviously can observe. Mm-hmm. Can he seize anything while he's there?
Well, I think if it's in plain view, he could. If there's an obvious connection here, if he sees the body and notices that she's been stabbed 11 times and sees a bent butcher knife in the floor, I think the police could probably seize that as plain view evidence. The initial responding officers are usually very reluctant to do anything like that, though. They want to leave everything to the evidence technician because they may disturb fingerprint evidence or other possible trace evidence.
So what of the items seized here would constitute plain view evidence?
Well, I guess maybe not the blood swabbings, because I think they had to be analyzed, but probably the other physical items, the knives, the handle, the two telephones, the purse and the keys, although I'm not sure what the evidentiary value was of a lot of those items. I mean, I think the knife, certainly, that was a potential weapon that was used here. What the connection to the other items was, I never was clear about that. But I think if the officer entered and saw the knife, they could pick that up. Usually they don't because they're concerned about fingerprint evidence and interfering with blood evidence here. So I think under the totality of the circumstances here, there was exigent circumstances sufficient to permit a nighttime search of the residence. The other point that's already been made.
Now, tell me the exigent circumstance that you're identifying, because as we went around, it seemed that you were saying the police did not have the house completely secured. Therefore, the exigent circumstance was that someone would go back into the house.
Yes, I think that's the exigent circumstance. There were two doors to the house.
But that's premised on the proposition that the police did not have it secured and were not in a position to prevent people from going in.
Well, I think that's true. If they have an officer stationed at the front door and the back door, they could have stayed there for 4 hours. But then the question is, well, if you're going to require that, then are you ever going to allow a nighttime search warrant to be executed? And that's what the trial judge was trying to deal with here.
Well, how does this interact with the traditional search warrant cases? I think the U.S. Supreme Court case was Segura or something, but there are cases where the police are at a residence and they conclude they need to secure the scene so they can go get a warrant, and they leave one officer there and tell everybody to stay seated where they are, don't disturb anything, and then another officer goes and gets a warrant and comes back. And the United States Supreme Court has said you have authority to secure the premises while you try to secure a warrant. Wouldn't that situation apply here?
Well, I think so, yes. I think you're certainly entitled to do that. You're just attempting to preserve what's an obvious crime scene. I think the police were entitled to do that. Bottom line on all this, as I think has already been pointed out, is at worst this was harmless error, since the limited physical evidence that was introduced was cumulative to the other highly incriminatory evidence that had already been introduced. There was eyewitness testimony from Dominic Curd. She testified in her direct examination that Mr. Scott made some statements that her mother was going to die that night, and then her words were, he stabbed her. I think there's eyewitness testimony.
Let me ask you one other question on the exigent circumstances. Is it the state's position that this court should recognize that a crime scene always constitutes an exigent circumstance? I mean, if you look at the nighttime statute, it seems to contemplate people are in a house, they may be asleep, it's the night, and therefore the warrant shouldn't be executed in the nighttime unless there are exigent circumstances. This case is about as opposite of that as you can get. No one's in the house, so no one's going to be disturbed, and it's a crime scene. And there may be a need to gather evidence. So is the state's position that by the nature of this case, that residence being a crime scene in and of itself constitutes an exigent circumstance?
Well, I don't think that alone is enough. I think you have to have something else. And the concern was that relatives of Kim Odom might attempt to enter, and that was the real concern, was to prevent the crime scene from being disturbed by these other people who, you know, innocently enough, maybe just trying to retrieve the children's clothes or playthings, but that was the concern of the police. But ultimately, I think any possible error in the trial court's ruling on the suppression motion has to be harmless. There was eyewitness testimony about the homicide. There were numerous self-incriminatory statements made by Mr. Scott himself, and that even if this limited physical evidence that was seized is taken out of the case, there was more than sufficient evidence for the jury to conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Scott was guilty.
Is it your recollection that there was no fingerprint?
I don't recall any fingerprint evidence, so I don't know if either it wasn't analyzed or they simply didn't find anything that they could identify as attributable to Mr. Scott. I just don't know if there was anything. I know there were.
Or the victim.
For the victim, yes. And Mr. Scott didn't actually testify at the trial. I think he testified at the suppression hearing, but he didn't testify at trial. The last issue concerns the abuse of discretion, if there was any abuse of discretion by the trial judge in his evidentiary ruling regarding potential defense impeachment of a prosecution witness, April Stinson. The defense wanted to impeach her because she had entered a Track 2 drug diversion program shortly
before. Do you agree
before.
That under that procedure, it's discretionary with the Attorney General? The Attorney General is the gatekeeper for who goes into that program.
Yes, I think that's true.
I was surprised neither you nor the defense cited Michael v. State. It's a case from the 1980s by the Delaware Supreme Court, and in that case, a witness named Cutrafellow had entered into an agreement to have DUI charges dropped, that it came up even in a motion for re-argument. But in that case, our court held whether or not there was a quid pro quo between the dropping of the charges, it should have been disclosed, and it was something that could have been pursued. And so my question is, why isn't some type of arrangement with the state, whether or not it was a quid pro quo for the testimony, relevant that this particular witness was engaged in another relationship with a state that resulted in favorable treatment for that witness?
Well, I think it may be relevant, but the trial judge's ultimate ruling was under Rule of Evidence 403, which says that even if it's relevant, it can still be excluded on a number of different alternative bases. And what the trial judge found was that it would be unfairly prejudicial to the state to try to impeach the witness with her entry into this drug diversion program. There was no...
Help us understand that. I mean, as you know, having argued the other side, whenever one side gets evidence in, it's prejudicial. And that's why the other side would like the evidence excluded. But here, what they wanted to show was that this witness might have entered into a favorable relationship with the state, and that should be taken into consideration. Now, why should that be excluded? Whenever anyone has a favorable relationship with the state, if it's a quid pro quo, the jury gets to hear about it. Why isn't there something implicit that the jury might consider?
Well, I think if that was the case, you probably wouldn't need 403. You would just say, if it's relevant, it's got to come in. And there is this gatekeeping
authority. Well, what we have superimposed in this case is the Sixth Amendment. You have a right to confront people and cross-examine them. This isn't simply a plain vanilla evidentiary ruling. This is an assertion of a federal constitutional right.
No, I think that's true, but it's still ultimately what it comes down to is a harmless error analysis, that even if the trial judge was incorrect in his discretionary ruling here, the state position is that he was not incorrect, that this was an appropriate exercise of discretion, that still it's harmless error beyond a reasonable doubt. April Stinson, if her testimony is examined in detail, she's a next-door neighbor. There was another neighbor, Stacy Scott, who was actually a niece of Mr. Scott, the accused in this case. What they testified to, they were not in the house, although I think Stacy Scott may have been in the house briefly before the stabbing, was that they saw things outside the house. They also heard Mr. Scott yelling. What April Stinson saw was Mr. Scott push the homicide victim, Elaine Curd, out her front door or down the front steps, and she saw that. And she said she also testified to hearing Mr. Scott yelling. Afterwards, she saw the homicide victim outside on the ground and went up to her, and I think she said she put blankets on her or something like that. That testimony is simply cumulative to the other testimony of Stacy Scott. So even if there was an abuse of discretion in not allowing her to be impeached by this drug diversion thing, it has to be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, given the other testimony in the case. If there's any other questions in the few seconds I have left, I'll try to answer those.
Thank you.
I wanted to first of all try to address the harmless error issue, because I don't feel like I made that very clear. Excuse me. First of all, to answer your question, Justice Berger, my understanding is there was no fingerprint match on the weapon. There was blood of both Mr. Scott and Ms. Curd found on the knife as well as in the house. With respect to the harmless error issue, physical evidence is very significant. There was blood everywhere in this house. To hear people dryly say, you know, this is what happened, is significantly different than a jury seeing the scene and the gruesomeness of the scene. So it would be hard-pressed for the state to say it had no influence whatsoever on the jury in attaining the conviction. The other thing is, with respect to the...
Did the police have the authority under the exigent circumstances of entering the house to seize at least the weapon?
No. And here's why. The crime had already been committed. It was outside the house that she was found. They had no basis to see, to think that there was anything else going on in the house. Therefore, the plain view test wouldn't apply. To answer your earlier question, if that wasn't allowed, then can they rely on the fact that it was later secured? I think that the fact that it was later secured is a fact. It's not similar to... that's sort of the inverse of what the state would argue on inevitable discovery. they can't rely on the early one. So I do think they could still rely on the fact that the house was secured, even if the state did not have the right to go in to secure it to begin with. The trial court also indicated that this would lead to a reduction of nighttime search warrants. The court did not say it would eliminate it. And that's, first of all, that's consistent with the purpose of exigent circumstances. Secondly, there would still be times when there would be a basis for the nighttime search warrant in murder cases, as the court indicated, if someone's in the house and there's more potential for loss of evidence. To address Justice Holland's point with respect to when someone's in the house sleeping, that's what this exigent circumstances are designed to protect. In Hanna v. State, this court found that even though there was no one in the house at the time that the search took place, there was still protection because, as I stated earlier, it is the sanctity of the house that is being protected. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement and take a brief recess.